Can I have a seat? Thanks, Jen. That was beautiful. It was really awesome. Well, this morning, Pastor Ernesto asked me originally if I would be willing to share my testimony with you all. Some of you have heard that before. Some of you haven't. But then as the week went on, it turned into, hey, will you share a message too? So I was like, okay, let me see if I can, put this all together. So I'm going to share my story with you all today. And at the end, I have a few small points to make. So not a big message, just a few things I want to hit home. But the main point of our time together here is just to share my story with you and hope that it's an encouragement with you. So heads up, I'm going to talk about my past a little bit. Some of the things I'm going to talk about are adult in nature. So if you have kids that are at that point, that are watching online, I don't see many in here, but, that are at the point of asking questions about certain things, maybe, and you're not ready to answer those questions, maybe don't have them listen. But, So my name is Rick. For those of you who don't know, I usually lead worship here on Sundays, but I like to teach sometimes, too, and share, and when I feel like the Lord's given me something to say. I am married. My wife, Megan, many of you guys know her. She works in the kids area in the back. I have four kids. My daughter is the one who sings really loud during the second service. You can usually hear her over the speakers. I'm a very blessed man. And you've heard Ernesto kind of tell over the past few months about how we were working on a house. And, that's a never-ending project, of course. We're living in it, and it's a blessing. It's wonderful. It's still a lot of work to be done. My life is very rich. I feel very rich. I'm not rich as a person, right? I don't have a lot of money, but I'm rich in the sense that the Lord has blessed me heavily, and I feel very joyful, and I feel very happy with content with what he's given to me. But that hasn't always been the case. So I'm 37 years old. I was born and raised in Pontiac, Michigan. And what's funny is I told God I never wanted to go back to Pontiac. I was like, I never want to go back to that place. And I made the mistake of telling that to Ernesto one time. And he goes, I told God I would never go back to Flint, Michigan. And look where I am now. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know about that. But so I grew up in Pontiac. I was raised by a single mother. I have an older brother and a younger sister. So there's three kids. We were raised by a single mother. We were very poor. Substance abuse, other types of abuse were very prevalent in my family, in my extended family, uncles, aunts, extended family. And so substances were a big part of my childhood. I remember being very young. My mother sold cocaine out of our house. There was a lot of people coming and going, not so good people for having little kids. There was a lot of addicts or drug users that would come in and out, men that would be in and out of the picture with my mom. I remember having a very violent childhood in the sense of I would see a lot of fist fights in the yard. I would see, people getting hurt. I woke up many times in the middle of the night to our front door getting kicked in. It was very scary and traumatic. Like I said, we were really poor, and so we couldn't really keep the lights on all the time or keep water running. And so there would be times where we'd come home and the water wouldn't work or the lights wouldn't work. And that was just something you dealt with as a kid. You didn't really think too much about it, but you just never knew if that stuff was going to disappear. And so very turbulent, very traumatic in that way. My father was not in the picture very much. My father, like I said, my mom was single, so they were divorced, they were separated. But my dad was an alcoholic. He drank like a fish. And, he and my mom, they grew up in the 70s where everybody they used to tell me stories about, the partying they would do and the drugs they would do and the crazy concerts they would go see. He was real big into rock and roll. He always wore a leather jacket everywhere he went and Chuck Taylors. And he was like the epitome of rock and roll. But the problem was is he got addicted to drinking. And it ruined his whole life. It controlled his life. And so me as his son, his only son, that's all I knew him as. All I knew him as was a guy who was always drunk. And he was really violent when he was drunk. So you know, the courts mandated that my mom would let me spend time with him. But he didn't have a license because he was, he drank a lot. He was a drunk. So he had a bicycle, a 10-speed bicycle from the 80s that had those skinny tires. And he had like a seat on the back. And so I would stand out in the front yard and I would wait for, he'd say, okay, I'm coming today. I'm going to pick you up. We're going to go out and go to the mall or go shopping or get dinner or whatever. And I would stand on the corner and I'd wait for hours and hours. And sometimes he would show up and sometimes he wouldn't. But every time that he did show up, he was wasted. And so my mom had to let me get in the seat. And I would get in that seat, and we would wobble in and out of traffic, and we would, you know, fall down. And a couple times he, you know, we would fall, and he ran me over one time and broke my arm. I was like 5. You know, and so, like, my experiences with him were always that chaotic, okay? And so I'd come home where I was supposed to be safe, and the experiences at home were chaotic and violent too. I remember watching my dad get into a fist fight in the front yard of his house. I was about 6, and he got his head caved in on a rock. And there was a lot of blood, and I remember helping him into the bathroom of the house, and there was blood everywhere in the sink, in the tub, and I was helping him wash his hair and his girlfriend too, and bringing them towels and trying to help them clean up. And so I got used to this violence and this just this insane life when I was a kid, and I kind of normalized it. And, I learned very early on that there was no safe place and there were no safe men, and that everything that I had to do all the time and everything I did, I always had to keep my head on a swivel. So I was like 5, 6, 7 years old, and I learned to watch my back everywhere I went. So, and that's something that I still do today. And it's a habit that I can't quit. I mean, I'm always watching like the exits and everything all the time. It's just part of who I am now. So, like, you know, when I was a kid, it was a very, like I said, it was a very turbulent childhood. And, there's a lot of fear, a lot of doubt. Some of the men that my mom brought around were not kind to me. They didn't like my dad. So I faced a lot of verbal abuse when I was a kid. And my brother and my sister would be favored, and I would be told I was worthless for years, just told I was terrible and worthless and miserable, and I was a loser, and I sucked, and all these different things. And so I believed that. I was 7, 8 years old, and that's what I believed about myself. So I had a very low self-esteem for a long, long time. It was hard to break out of that as a man. But, the Lord's good. And one night, somebody knocked on our door. It was one of those men. It was his dad. And his dad was a good man. And he came and he knocked on the door and he said to my mom, he said, Mickey, do you know who Jesus is? And she said, no. And so he said, can I come in and talk to you? So he came in. We knew him. He came in and he prayed with my mom, and she became a believer that night. And in that instant, she did a complete 180 with her life. She stopped with the drugs and the alcohol. She cut bad people out of her life, and she started making her kids and her faith her priority. And so it was a whirlwind of a change for us, you know, as kids, but we were along for the ride. We're like, whatever, you know, do what you're going to do, Mom. And she picked us up, and she moved us out of the city up into Marlette, Michigan, which is up in the Thumb. And that's where I live today, you know. It's a lot of people up there try to get out. I was like, I'm ready to come in. Like, I want to stay here. It was a great place. And so I was about 11 years old. It was 1996, and we moved up there. Now, throughout my childhood and throughout my teenage years up in Marlette, I still had a relationship with my dad, but it was very broken. It was very bad. And so I would be the person who put forth the effort. I would have to go see him because he didn't have a license. He couldn't drive up there. So I would have to go drive to him, go see him, visit him. He was always drunk. He was always getting into a fight. And I remember so many times in my childhood where I would come home from school, and my dad was a wild man. I would come home from school and I would get a phone call, and it would be a long-lost relative on my dad's side that says, hey, Rick, your dad has been stabbed. He was in a street fight and he got stabbed and he's not going to make it. You need to come down to the hospital right away. So we would get in the car and we'd drive down to Pontiac. We'd go to the hospital. We'd say my goodbyes, all that stuff, with my dad, and then he would make it. And so we'd come home. A couple years later, I'd always be expecting that call. A couple years later, I got another call. Your dad was in a fight. He got ran over by a car. He got smashed between two cars, and he's not going to make it. You need to come down to the hospital. So I would come home. He survived. I was about 14 or 13 the last time. Hey, Rick, your dad got into a fight gambling at some illegal, you know, poker house. He got shot a couple times. He got shot in the back. He's not going to make it. You need to come down here. And so I learned that every phone call that came through had the chance of being a terrible phone call, a tragedy. Somebody in your family is dead, or somebody in your family's been hurt really bad. And so I learned to expect that. And still today when I answer the phone, I always have that little twinge of like, uh-oh, like what's this news gonna be? And so as I grew, I started to just expect those things. And I started to accept the fact that me as a person, my life was always going to be that. I was always going to be the person who had some type of tragedy happening. I was never going to be stable. I wasn't good enough for, you know, to be liked or loved. And there was always going to be something bad happening. And so, you know, like I said, my mom moved us out of the city. She moved us up to Marlette. And those things continued. But there was something that changed in that time. She made us start attending a church, okay? A little country church. My mom worked in the evenings and on the weekends, so we never saw her. My older brother and I were alone all the time. We fed ourselves, we bathed ourselves, we got ready for school, all that stuff. But my mom worked really hard, and she tried to provide a stable home for us. But it was the first time that I felt safe in my home. And it was a very unique experience because I was also attending this church. And that's the church where I actually met Angie and Ernesto. Angie was the youth group leader at the time, which she's not here today. But you know, I met those guys. And in that church, in that community, is the first time that a man, Angie's dad, had ever taken an interest in me and wanted to invest in me in a safe and loving way. He taught me how to camp. He taught me how to do woodworking. He spent time with me teaching me how to go snorkeling and fun things like that. And there were other men that came around, my brother and I and my sister, and they just were just a positive role model for our family. And it felt really good. It felt like paradise for the first time. I felt safe, and I loved life. It was a really awesome time. But, you know, like a young man does in the early 2000s when you have access to the internet and no parent at home to keep an eye on you, I discovered pornography pretty young. I was 11 or 12 when I discovered that. And I had seen that before. My dad used to frame pictures from his Playboy magazines and hang them on his walls. So when I was, I think my earliest memory of him, I was, I think, 4 years old, going to his house and climbing up on the couch and looking at that on the wall. And so I had seen these things, and it piqued my interest. And when I got access to that on my own, I fell in deeply to that. And so as a young man, you know, I was a teenager. It's natural for boys to think that way. I got really involved in that. And that was a hidden thing of mine for a long time because I was trying to be involved in my church. I was doing missions with my youth group. I was working in the worship band. I was, you know, trying to just do good and be a good kid. But I had this, you know, thing that was growing in me. And, you know, as I went through high school, I started to really see some of the cracks in who I was. I started to realize that there were some issues deep down inside. And it started to come out early because people would ask me, you know, when you live in the city, you understand brokenness. You see it. Like, there's more people you can see brokenness around you. But when you're in this isolated little community up there, it looks like everybody's got their act together on the surface. You know, most of my friends had both parents in the home. Most of them had stable jobs. Most of them had houses. And I'm living in an income-based, you know, apartment over here with no parent around. And they would ask me, like, where's your dad? What does your dad do? And I would have to lie, or I'd have to, you know, come up with an excuse on why it was really cool that my dad, like, oh, my dad got shot and he can survive. And they'd all be like, whoa, you know, your boy's like on the playground. You know, I'm like in sixth grade and I'm telling stories. And it became this like badge of pride for me. And that's how I justified what I went through as a child. But really the reality was is that I was really broken and I didn't know who I was and I didn't know life outside of that. So as I got older and as I grew up into high school, I started dating, right? Like young people do when they're in high school. But I couldn't commit to things. I'd never seen healthy commitment in my life. I couldn't commit to things. And I couldn't commit to a relationship either. And so I bounced around in relationships. And those relationships were innocent enough at first, but then as I got older, they became a little more involved physically, and I started making some poor choices, and I started hurting people. And so about the time I graduated high school, I had gotten into this habit where I couldn't commit to a relationship with a girl, but I could definitely like get enough of the relationship going to get what I wanted out of that relationship, which was a physical relationship. And so I had this track record behind me of those experiences, and I wasn't proud of that. But it was around that time also that our church went through a really nasty church split. So our pastor got kicked out. My family got really hurt by the experience, and we walked away from that community, and we said, we're never going back. And so up until just a few months ago, my family, I was the only one in my family who had ever gone back to church. And so it took a real deep toll on us, a lot of spiritual and emotional hurt, which is a story for another time. But that's about the time that my life started to go downhill. I was getting into that. That pornography stuff was growing into an addiction for me, and it started to really sink in heavily, and I started to realize that it was an addiction. And, getting into poor relationships was also an addiction that I had, and it got to a point where it wasn't even relationships anymore. It was just flings, one-night stands, things like that that just didn't really have any meaning. And so I started to really understand that I was broken, and I started to just feel really negative about life in general. Well, it was in 2008, I got a call, one of those phone calls, hey, Rick, your dad, he has cirrhosis of the liver, and it has turned into liver failure from his drinking, and he's in the hospital, and you need to come say goodbye to him. So I went down to the hospital expecting that this was probably the last time I was going to see my dad, and we had our broken relationship, but I loved him, and I had spent my whole life praying for this man to break that addiction and come home and be my dad, have a good relationship with me and love me and make me feel whole, and I wanted that so bad. But, we're in the hospital room. He was in there for 3 days, and I don't know if anybody of you ever seen, withdrawals from alcoholism before. Like, withdrawing from alcohol or withdrawing from a substance in general is very hard on your body. It's very difficult. But withdrawing from alcohol is one of the only substances that the withdrawals can actually kill you. And it's very, very difficult and miserable for that person. So he was in the hospital. Obviously, they didn't give him any alcohol in there. And the doctors came in on the last day before they released him, and they said, listen, your dad has liver failure. He is not going to survive 6 months if he doesn't stop drinking. In fact, he has 6 weeks if he continues to drink. And so they said if he stops drinking today, right now, he will have 6 months. And if he can stay sober for 6 months, then we will put him on the list for a liver transplant, and he can save his life. So I was really excited about that because I thought, hey, there's a chance here that he could change his life. This could be the wake-up call, get a new liver, new fresh start. And I remember sitting in that room with him, and I said, all right, Dad, they're going to discharge us. Let's get you home. I'll take care of you. I'll help you through this. And he looked at me and he said, I don't want to ride home. And I was like, why? And he said, I want to take the bus. And he didn't say it, but I knew the reason he wanted to take the bus is because he wanted to stop on the way at the store and buy a 40. And he wanted to get a 6-pack. And that's what he did. He got on the bus. He stopped and he got a 40. And he was drunk before he walked in the door at home by himself. And he chose his addiction at that point. He chose it. It was an out for him. And that broke my heart that day because I thought, this man who claims that he loves me and claims that I'm valuable to him as his only son, this man has chosen his addiction over me time and time again, but now he chose to end his life for this addiction. And so I really struggled with that. And over the next 6 years, he survived. He didn't die, like the doctor said. He survived 6 more years, but during that time, our relationship, it became nothing. I mean, I would visit him, it would surface level. Every time I visited the man, he was wasted. And I started to fall deeper into depression. And I remember getting to the point where I was contemplating suicide all the time. And it started out small with just a few thoughts, but then after a while, it grew into an everyday thing where I would daydream and romanticize and think about all the ways that I could do this to myself that wouldn't hurt my family or wouldn't leave my family devastated. And the reality was is that I didn't do it because I didn't have the nerve, and I couldn't figure out a way to not hurt my mom. I couldn't figure out a way to do it without hurting her, so I didn't do it. And I remember driving to work. I remember driving to work and just looking for trees to crash my truck into. And I remember thinking about, well, I can't find a tree, so I've got a shotgun under my bed at home. I'll go take care of it that way. And it was such a dark time in my life. It was really scary. And as the relationship with my dad went on, I was still in this addiction with pornography. I was still just like talking to different girls, and I would hook up with them for a night and never talk to them again. And it got to the point where I wasn't even going for the physical anymore. I just wanted the game of manipulating somebody's emotions to get them to like me. And I would do that, and I would feel accomplished that I had done that. And that was the goal. And then I would not talk to them anymore. And I broke a lot of people's hearts, and I hurt a lot of people in deep ways. And I feel, to this day, it's something I've had to repent for over and over again, because I feel so terrible about doing that to another one of God's creation, you know, to somebody that didn't deserve that. And so I was just miserable with myself. And I went down to visit my dad, and this was one of the last times I talked to him. It was 2014, and, you know, things were rough. His stomach had swelled up really large. That's what happens when your liver and kidneys fail. Your body can't filter out the liquid. So his stomach has swelled up. His belly button had turned inside out, and he caught it on something, and it burst open, and liquid would just pour out of him all the time. And so I would go and try to help him dress his wounds, and you know, every time I'd visit him, his shirts were always wet. It was just such a sad experience, and he was always drinking. And the last time that I ever spent time with him at home, he was upset, and he took me into the back bedroom, and I'll never forget it. He turned on Ozzy. Like I said, he loved rock and roll. He turned on Ozzy on his cassette player. Like, who has a cassette player? He turned on Ozzy, and he sat down, and he said, "I want to show you something." And he pulled up his pant legs, and the skin and the meat on his legs had rotted and turned black and died while he was still alive. And he was not, it was a very traumatic experience. And he looked at me, and he had tears in his eyes, and he had a broken smile on his face. He smiled at me, and he said, "I'm a dead man walking." And I looked at him, and in that moment, you think to yourself, I know Christ. I know who Jesus is. I know the hope that he gives. And I didn't say that to him. I didn't say, "There's still hope for you in this life and in the next life. You can know joy." I didn't say it to him. And instead, I just said, "You're right. You are." And I wish now that I had said something more. But the fact of the matter is, I didn't. And a couple weeks later, he went into the hospital, and he died a very difficult death. It was very painful, very difficult for him. And I remember just hitting rock bottom after that. And Megan, she was dating me at the time. I don't know why, but she was dating me at the time, and she helped me through that. And with her encouragement and with my mom's encouragement and the encouragement of my family, they said, "You've got to get some help," because I was in a dark place. And so I sought out therapy. Simple plan, right? I went to a therapist, and he said, "I'm going to recommend you to a psychiatrist. You have depression." And so they told me I had depression. They gave me a medication for that. They said, "You have an anxiety disorder from the experiences as a kid." And they gave me medication for that. And over the next couple years, I went on this medication, and I worked through this reality that I was mentally ill and I had problems and I needed to fix them. And I knew that there was more to life than just mental illness, but I had a broken relationship with Jesus and I had problems in my life that I needed to fix. And so I sought out those things. And it took a long time to get to a point where I was stable and I stopped having those thoughts. And one thing that I'm so grateful for is that Megan pushed me to go back to church. And we tried for quite a while to go to different churches. Nothing stuck. And she married me, which is, you know. But I got a call from Ernesto one day out of the blue, and he said, "I'm starting a church, and I want you to come sing." And I didn't know what to think of that. But I came, and the people that were here, and you all were here, and the people that were here came around our family, and I received support and healing that I never thought was possible. And the Lord did a mighty work in my heart. It wasn't instant. It took a long time. I've been doing this for 10 years. You guys know that. It took a long time to get to a point where I felt okay. And I'm just so grateful for our church. I don't think you guys understand how much I love this church. And the Lord did a mighty work in me, and he saved me, and he brought me away from those thoughts and that darkness in my mind. And, you know, through the help of my friends, through the help of Pastor Ernesto and John and so many other people, I was able to break that addiction to pornography 7 years ago, almost 7 years ago, let it go. It's been a tough journey, but, you know, he brought me out of it. And I will say that there's been some realizations that have happened to me over that time. And it, like I said, there was no one moment that fixed everything. I needed help. I needed medicine. I needed therapy. I still have problems, you guys. I cry during every stinking movie that, you know, every Disney movie, because I have, like, daddy issues, you know? So I'm like, I watched Coco the first time I realized it. And after we had our daughter, I watched Coco. Our daughter wasn't even watching the movie with us. It's just me and Megan watching Coco, and I'm just crying on the couch. And I'm like, man, like, I know I have some problems I need to work through. But you know what? At the end of it all, I have to look back. I have to let go of the frustrations and the anger that I felt towards my dad, and I have to let go of those things. He knew who Jesus was, and he did pray a prayer of salvation. I know he's in heaven. As messed up as he was, I know he knew the Lord. But you know, as I spent the next 10 years here at Flint City Church, I looked back on what it was that actually helped me get to a healthy place. And this is where the sermon comes in, or whatever I'm going to speak on. And it really became about understanding my purpose in life and understanding why I'm here and who I am. And so I want to share this with you, because if somebody would have told this to me when I was 13 years old, my life would have taken a different path. And it's a very simple and easy thing to understand. If you're a believer, this will hit home for you. If you don't know who Jesus is, you're not going to care about this. It's not going to make any sense. So if you don't know Jesus, and you hear this, and you want to talk about that, please come talk to me. I will tell you until I'm blue in the face what the Lord has done and how good he is. And I'm pretty convincing too, okay? So, but I want to share with you something that hit me. And it comes from the very first chapter of the Bible, Genesis 1. I got just a few verses I'm going to read. But Genesis 1 talks about creation, right? It talks about when God created the earth. And if you know the story, you know that God created the earth in a series of 7 days. Each day he spoke and something else was made. Something was created. And on the 7th day, he took a rest, okay? It's a pretty simple concept. But what I want to point out here starts, I'm just taking a snippet out of this. It happens in all 7 days, but I want to take a snippet out. And I'm going to start in verse 9. And it says, and God said, let the water, that's my old ringtone, I like that. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place and let dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds, just like he commanded it to. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning the third day. So what I want to point out here is that every time God created something, he took a step back at the end of the day, and he looked at it, and he said, this is good. What I've done with my hands is good, and I'm proud of it, and I'm happy about it. Now, the difference here is on the 6th day. Do you guys know what he created on the 6th day? Man and woman, right? So he created man and woman on the 6th day, his final creation. And the 6th day, this is his masterpiece, all right? He's painted the backdrop, he's painted the base, everything, and now he's going to put the denouement, the crown piece, right in the center of his painting. He's going to put the masterpiece there. And in verse 26, it says, then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. So he created people, and he said, you are going to be special. You're going to be in charge of everything else that I created. And so up until this point, everything that he created was good. But when he created man and woman, if you look at verse 31, it says, God saw all that he made and it was very good. Okay, and there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. When he created man and woman, he didn't say, what I've done is good, just like the rest. He said, I see my masterpiece and this creation is now very good. And I want to point out, it's a very subtle phrasing. It's a very subtle difference, good to very good. Okay, well, it's got to mean a lot. It's got a lot of weight behind it if God is saying it. Okay, so what I want to point out here is that there's one difference between the rest of his creation and you and I. And the difference is that he made us in his likeness. He made us in his image. He breathed his life into us. He gave us his heart, his character, and he gave us parts of him that the rest of creation, the plants, the animals, your dog, the cow, the fish in the sea, they did not get God's likeness like you and I did. And when he looked at us, when he was finished creating us, he said, this is very good. And the reason it was set apart was not because we're so special and we're so great. It's because he saw himself in us. He saw his own likeness in his creation, and he was happy with what he saw. He saw his own glory reflected back to him when he viewed us. And that's the key right there. We were created, set apart from the rest of creation. We were created, and we were special because we reflect God's glory naturally when we are made. Okay, that is our purpose in life. We are to continue to be a reflection of what God is. We weren't created because God wanted to have a little human to boss around. No, he created us because he wanted to see his glory in his creation, and we were the best avenue for that. And so that truth is still true today. Thousands of years ago, and in 1987, in Pontiac Osteopathic Hospital, or St. Joe's, or wherever, I don't know what the name is now. But that truth is the same. When I was created, I was a reflection of God, and I still am a reflection of him and his glory and all of his goodness. And I am still to continue to be that, whether I made bad choices, whether I was in addiction, whether I was broken, or whether I'm a man who walks the narrow path to the Lord. It doesn't matter. We are all of one purpose. Every single human on this earth was built to glorify God by being a reflection of his glory. Okay? Now, as you go on with your life, that is a very simple truth to understand. But there are wars fought over this, you guys. We have traversed space. We have gone to the Mariana Trench looking for the reason that we're alive, looking for aliens, looking for proof of life, looking for the reason why we exist. And it's simple. It's right here in the first chapter of the book. You are to be a reflection of God's glory. Now, as you go on with your life, there are going to be lots of choices that you have in front of you. Okay? Lots of choices. And it's going to lead you down different paths towards the Lord or away from the Lord. But the reality is that your purpose needs to be your motivation for everything in life. Every choice you make, every step you take needs to be motivated by the understanding that you are a reflection of God's glory. So as you choose to live your life, whether you're in high school, whether you're an adult in the workplace, whether you're struggling on the street, no matter where you are in life, every choice you make is meant to be motivated by that purpose. You need to motivate it with that purpose. Is this going to glorify God or is it not? Is this going to lift him up and be a reflection of his glory or is it not? And if it's not, you shear that off. You get rid of that path. You don't take that path. And as you grow and as you get older, you will realize that all these different choices, all these different paths that your life can take, you're shearing off the ones that are not glorifying to God. And before you know it, you're walking a narrow road. You're walking a narrow road that leads to intimacy and closeness with the Father and intimacy and closeness with Jesus. So your motivation needs to be your purpose. Why are we here? To glorify God. If I had known that when I was a teenager, man, I probably would have made a lot of different choices and I might not have experienced the hurt that I did or experienced the sin that I did. Now, I can say that that's a truth that I've learned over the last 10 years being a part of Flint City Church, and I could say, that I try to do that every day, but the reality is I fail at doing that all the time. Thank God for his grace because, I need it every day. But I want to challenge you today. I hope my story and my healing process and these things, I hope you understand that that's not because of something special that I did. And it's not solely because of medicine or because of a therapist or a doctor. And it's not only because I have a rock for a wife. That's not it. It's because the Lord is good. And it's because the Lord needs to be glorified. And when you glorify God with your life and you lift him up, he will bring healing and contentedness to you that you didn't know was possible. And the other part of that is you need to be with a family that can support you. I don't mean an immediate family, I mean a church family. You are not meant to be walking the road of faith by yourself. That's not how God created this faith to be. He created the believers to be one body, one mind, one spirit, and you need to be encouraged by your brothers and sisters. Because if you fall, you're going to be able to be lifted back up and encouraged. When I was breaking that addiction, I fell a lot of times. But you know what? Every single time I had men around me that would say, it's okay, we're going to start over. We're going to check on you. We're going to call you. We're going to put stuff on your computer. We're going to do what it takes. And I had tried in the past to break that, but I couldn't by myself. But when you have people around you to encourage you, it's going to lead you closer to that purpose of glorifying God with every aspect of your life. So I encourage you today, if you don't attend a church regularly or you don't have a body of believers around you, if this is your first time here, whatever, you come here. Find another church to go to. Just be in community with believers who will push you that way, okay? And understand that you have a purpose. You're not purposeless in this world. You were created for a purpose, and you better start glorifying the Lord because he will have his glory in the end, and I want to be a part of that. And it's not just for while you're alive on this earth. It's forever. 80 years is not what he created you for. He didn't create you for 80 years of glory and worship. He created you for an eternity of worship. He wants to see you forever around his throne. And I hope that we all get to be there together. And I encourage you in that. So with that being said, I'm going to close us out in prayer. But I want to let you know, if you don't know the Lord or you want to talk more or whatever, I'm here, you know, anytime. I'm always willing to chat and pray for you or whatever. And I hope you guys pray for me because this walk isn't over. So let's pray together. Jesus, we thank you for your kindness to us. We thank you for your redemption. Thank you for your grace. Thank you that you created us not as just another piece of creation, but you created us with a purpose and you gave us a reason for being here. We don't have to wander. We don't have to wonder. Lord, you're good and we love you and we are so grateful for you, Jesus. Thank you for saving us. Thank you for your body. Thank you for the community of believers. We love you today, Lord. We praise your name, Jesus. Amen.